Chapter 12, Amateurs. As Joe Biden stood in the White House driveway just past noon on June 24th, he was practically glowing with excitement. With Kirsten Sinema, the nettlesome Arizona Democrat, to his left, and Rob Portman, the sober Ohio Republican, to his right, the president announced a breakthrough in bipartisan negotiations. A group of 10 senators in both parties had forged an agreement to spend $1.2 trillion to repair and modernize the nation's tattered infrastructure. After months of negotiations, a deal was in hand. "This reminds me of the days we used to get an awful lot done up at the United States Congress," Biden crowed. "We had bipartisan deals. Bipartisan deals mean compromise." The infrastructure deal had emerged from painstaking late-night talks between an independent-minded group of Republican senators and centrist Democrats in the Senate and the White House. Of the five Republican negotiators, all but one had voted to convict Donald Trump at his impeachment trial earlier in the year. The fifth, Rob Portman, had already announced his plans to retire from the Senate, putting him beyond reach of conservative primary voters who loathed Biden. Like the president, many of these lawmakers pined for the old days of deal-making in the Senate. Several of them had attended the funeral of John Warner that very week, and before they went out with Biden to announce the deal, both Susan Collins and Mark Warner invoked the spirit of the late Virginia centrist. "Let's get this done," they told Biden. In meetings with the Senate negotiators, Biden had spoken effusively about the importance of reaching a deal. Collins recalls Biden saying that friends and adversaries across the globe kept questioning whether America's institutions were still strong and working. He said Emmanuel Macron, the young French president, was among the world leaders who had told Biden that America's leadership role was at risk because of the country's inability to get anything done at home. Biden dreamed of proving Macron wrong, and for a moment outside the White House, he basked in what he saw as the realization of that dream. Then political reality reasserted itself in the form of the Speaker of the House. Nancy Pelosi thought the infrastructure deal was pathetically unambitious. She did not share Biden's sentimental view of bipartisanship as a mode of governing or of the Senate as an institution. Her party was assembling a massive package of social welfare and climate programs in a reconciliation bill even larger than the American Rescue Plan. The emerging bill was a colossal piece of legislation that would pour money into clean energy and grant the American people robust new benefits ranging from government-backed child care to dental insurance for the elderly. One version of the package, drafted by Bernie Sanders as the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, totaled $6 trillion in spending over a decade. On a personal level, Pelosi also seemed to feel the infrastructure deal was just too small to serve as a capstone achievement in her epic career. She had not held on to the speakership into her 80s and held her party together through the grim days of the Trump administration to fill some potholes. Pelosi knew, too, that her caucus was not about to curb its ambitions in order to pass an infrastructure deal that reflected Mitt Romney's priorities better than their own. That was not just an assessment based on intuition. Earlier the same month, Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, had informed Pelosi that her 96-member bloc had taken an internal vote, and a strong majority would not vote for an infrastructure bill before the larger reconciliation package was complete. In a small meeting with the heads of other Democratic factions, Pelosi had asked Jayapal, "You don't trust the president?" The speaker reminded Jayapal, a third-term lawmaker, that this was her first time serving under a Democratic president. Dealing with Biden was not the same as dealing with Donald Trump. "Of course I trust the president," Jayapal replied, "but I don't trust my colleagues in the Senate." Speaking to the press on June 24th, shortly before Biden's festive turn in the driveway, Pelosi said the House would not take action on an infrastructure bill until the Senate passed the much larger reconciliation package that was still being negotiated. "In fact, I use the word ain't," Pelosi said. "There ain't going to be an infrastructure bill unless we have the reconciliation bill passed by the United States Senate." Pelosi issued that public ultimatum without consulting the president. And in a private interview the following day, on June 25th, she seemed pleased about that fact, chuckling softly when asked if she had given Biden a heads up. "Oh, no, I just said it." Biden heard her loud and clear. Little more than an hour after his appearance with the infrastructure negotiators, Biden struck a new tone in the East Room of the White House. Appearing with prominent members of his own administration involved in the deal, Biden again hailed it as an important breakthrough that would prove to the world that we can function, deliver, and do significant things. But he added a Pelosi-like caveat. He would only sign the bill if it came to his desk alongside separate social welfare and climate legislation. To Biden's Republican interlocutors in the Senate, it was a stunning addendum. They had seen themselves as negotiating a standalone bill, one that represented a set of spending priorities on which both parties could reach consensus. Now it sounded like they had been lured into endorsing one appendage of an expansive Democratic agenda. Steve Ricchetti, the Biden adviser who had led negotiations for the White House, rushed to calm the Republican bloc. Phoning moderates on the Hill, he acknowledged that Biden had blundered. "We're fixing this," he told them. In a few cases, Ricchetti asked the president to make his own calls of reassurance to senators. Biden spoke for 20 minutes with Portman, explaining to the Ohioan that he planned to issue a statement walking back his comments and inviting Portman to offer edits on the draft via Ricchetti, a fellow Ohioan. The Republican infrastructure negotiators let Biden off the hook. Senators like Portman and Collins and Romney earnestly wanted a deal, and they were not about to walk away because of a verbal blunder by a president known for making them. Biden's comments had exposed an authentic political tension that his damage control efforts could not erase. He had staked his presidency on twin promises to ease the country's partisan warfare and to deliver comprehensive economic and social change. By the end of June, he had devised a pair of legislative vehicles to achieve both goals. Now Biden had to convince his entire party to support both bills, and he wanted to do it without alienating the Republicans who were willing to lend their backing to the more modest of the two proposals. He attempted to do so by keeping his legislative strategy awkwardly opaque and, for months, never definitively articulating when and in what order he wanted to pass the pieces of his agenda into law. This approach allowed both liberals and moderates to imagine that Biden was, in his heart of hearts, on their side. It was a statement on the Democratic Party's fractious internal politics that Biden and his advisers believed such deliberate vagueness was necessary to avert sharp conflict between the party's factions. But in the absence of clear direction from the president, Biden's party sank into an anguished, months-long standoff on Capitol Hill. Combined with grim developments overseas and in the domestic economy, the stalemate badly sapped Biden's political momentum. In the summer of 2021, Biden and the Democratic Party's congressional leaders had to navigate that extraordinarily delicate process amid a darkening national mood and a calamitous sequence of events in Afghanistan that badly damaged the White House's image of studied competence. At every step, the president would be pulled between his impulse toward seeking consensus and his hunger for titanic achievement, between the centrist wing of his party, in which he had spent most of his career, and the left wing, that now seemed far more invested in the greatness of President Biden. If the opening months of Biden's presidency felt like a season of relief from the darkest days of the Trump era, the period from July into the early autumn came as a stark reminder of profound national defects that transcended any one presidency. The national vaccination campaign slowed due to hesitancy among conservative and lower-income Americans, and the Delta variant of the coronavirus tore through poor communities, especially in red states where Republican governors pandered to vaccine skeptics. With the debate fully politicized, disputes over public health restrictions were leading to screaming matches in retail stores and county government buildings and death threats against local health officials. The resurgence of the disease led to a slowdown in the country's economic recovery and stoked fears that many consumers might feel the pinch of inflation before they reaped the benefits of new prosperity. As early as late June, some of Biden's counselors were already contemplating the possibility that Republicans could retake Congress in 2022. When an advisor to Bernie Sanders contacted Ricchetti to warn him that the midterms could get ugly if Biden did not pass his most ambitious domestic policies into law soon, the presidential aide gave a less than reassuring response. You know, Ricchetti said, a lot of people around Biden weathered the 1990s and did battle with Newt Gingrich. We know how to handle a Republican Congress. He sounded like a man anticipating a divided government. About 6 months into his tenure, Biden was starting to wonder if he was approaching the end of the most productive phase of his presidency. During a visit in Delaware with Chris Coons, the state's respected junior senator, Biden wondered aloud whether the reconciliation package would be the last landmark legislation of his term. Coons was worried about his friend, the president. In Coons' reckoning, Biden's return to electoral politics had been a monumental personal sacrifice. At age 78, the president deserved to be playing golf and hanging out with his grandchildren, Coons felt, rather than striving daily to save democracy. The president was deeply involved in raising his grandkids. He was known to put aside his work to take their calls, include them at White House gatherings, and make a point of attending their athletic events or bringing them out golfing when he returned to Delaware. In his brief time as a private citizen after 2016, Biden had directed a large chunk of the money he earned from paid speaking engagements toward funding their college tuitions. Though none would say so openly, Biden's age was a constant subject of private discussion among Democrats, particularly those who had known him for a long time. Biden's voice remained sharp and authoritative on matters of policy, but his stories were longer and more repetitive. He tired more easily, traveled less, and took longer to recall people's names. The president knew it, too. Catching up with one friend over the summer, Biden briefly drew a blank on the name of one of the new firebrand House Republicans whom he found so deplorable, and sighed to his guest that recalling such things used to be easier. During his visit with Biden in Delaware, Coons told the president that he saw great promise in the remaining years of his presidency. Biden, he said, could use the convening power of his office to gather congressional leaders and encourage grand compromises on issues like immigration, gun violence, and labor law. The president could keep creating the space for deal-making, Coons said, much as he had done with infrastructure. Biden heard him out. He wanted to believe it was possible. I'm holding on to that hope, Biden said. But the president could not conceal his skepticism. The path to a bipartisan infrastructure bill had been hard enough, and Biden knew that bill was still a long way from reaching his desk. Joe Biden and his aides had resurrected bipartisan talks over infrastructure through willpower and persistence after they had seemed to fall apart altogether in early June. The president's talks with Senate Republicans led by Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia had stalled so long that they no longer seemed useful. Capito confided to Biden during the extended talks that her Republican colleagues called her the dreamer for thinking she could strike a deal. Then, in a phone call on June 8th, Capito acknowledged to the president that things were not working out. I was worried we were headed to a breakup, she joked gamely, according to a person briefed on the conversation. Yet as soon as Capito was sidelined, a different set of Senate centrists rushed into the void, including her fellow West Virginian Joe Manchin, who seldom passed up the chance to upstage his Republican colleague. Weeks of furious talks had yielded the package Biden announced on June 24th. It was now likely to pass the Senate in a matter of weeks. Across party lines, the group of negotiators shared a conviction that getting something done on a bipartisan basis was an inherently good thing, even if it left all participants somewhat dissatisfied. Mitt Romney had told his colleagues that he was willing to vote for a good bit of policy he did not like simply for the sake of showing the country the Senate could actually function as the collegial body it was meant to be. On July 14th, Biden met with a bipartisan contingent of mayors who found him luxuriating in the breakthrough. The city executives, including David Holt of Oklahoma City and Nan Whaley of Dayton, Ohio, were ostensibly there to talk with Biden about what the legislation would do for their cities. But in the Oval Office, they heard Biden captivated with the bill's secondary purpose, restoring an image of functionality to the American government. The very same day, Biden attended a lunch of Democratic senators on Capitol Hill and reiterated that point. The Trump years had been a humiliation for the United States in the eyes of the world, Biden said, according to notes from an attendee. The president told the assembled lawmakers that when he attended the G7 summit in the United Kingdom, He had faced painful questions about January 6th. The credibility of the American system was on the line. But Biden conveyed to that group that the infrastructure bill alone would not be enough to redeem American democracy. The country had to master climate change and restore the public's confidence in the fairness of the economy. Republicans, he said, were trying to win the blue-collar voters by campaigning on culture and the prejudice game. Briefly affecting a Southern accent and alluding to his home state's rural element, Biden allowed that Democrats would never win wacko racists. But he argued there was a real political opportunity for his party if they could pass major legislation to give working people a break. The infrastructure bill alone would not do that. 8 days later, with the bill nearing Senate approval, Biden gathered an assortment of business federations for a meeting in the Roosevelt Room. With Cedric Richmond at his right elbow and Steve Ricchetti to his left, a visible display of centrist political muscle, Biden hailed the infrastructure deal as a consensus-based plan for economic growth. But the president also confided to the assembled business leaders that the politics were complicated. He could not talk about the legislation as a big victory for Democrats, lest he alienate Republicans whose votes he wanted, nor could he talk about it as a huge win for the GOP because his side did not want to strengthen Donald Trump's party. As Biden hinted to Chris Coons, he suspected the infrastructure bill might be the one and only great bipartisan legislation of his presidency. Opposition even to that legislation was already gathering in the House. When Kevin McCarthy met with the Problem Solvers Caucus on July 1st, a week after Biden announced the deal, the House Republican leader predicted that the legislation would flop among his members. There would be fewer than 10 GOP votes for the bill in the House, McCarthy promised. He was not afraid House Republicans would pay a political price for voting against the popular bipartisan measure. McCarthy's counterpart in the Senate was handling the moment differently. To Mitch McConnell, long loathed by Democrats for his obstructionism, the infrastructure bill looked like a moment for cooperation. He had assured members of his conference that if they struck a deal, he would not stand in its way. But now the Senate leader was thinking of going beyond merely not fighting the legislation. He was thinking of actually voting for it. McConnell had political motives beyond any sense of graciousness or assessment of the legislation's merits. He knew well that the most moderate members of the Democratic caucus were intensely invested in the infrastructure deal. If Republicans helped it become law, it would be a validation of the centrists' worldview, proof that the Senate could work through consensus and compromise. By approving the deal, McConnell believed he could help armor the Senate's rules against liberal reformers who wanted to end the filibuster and free themselves to govern on a party-line basis. He had said as much in private earlier in the summer, telling a group of GOP donors in June that the bipartisan legislation was a way of defanging restive elements of Biden's party. There are many, many Democrats in the Senate, and I'll bet the same in the House, that are pulling for these bipartisan negotiations to fail, McConnell said, so they can say, again, don't waste your time with the Republicans. If that argument carried the day on the Democratic side, then there might be no stopping the reconciliation package that McConnell feared far more than anything in the infrastructure bill. By the middle of July, he was using stark language to describe his alarm about that developing legislation. McConnell's view, as he articulated it then, if they succeed with this massive bill, we will never be able to undo it, and I think it is a turning point for the country, and this is going to be one big fight. For McConnell to have even a shot at prevailing in that fight, he needed the most devoted centrists on the Democratic side to hold their ground and maintain their faith in bipartisanship. On August 10th, the Senate voted by a margin of 69-30 to approve the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. Among the lawyers voting aye was the senior senator from Kentucky. Some Republican senators facing re-election in 2022 held back from voting for the infrastructure bill, apparently out of concern that Trump would attack them in their primaries if they supported it. When John Thune, the pragmatic South Dakotan, voted against the measure, McConnell remarked to him dryly, "Well, I guess you are running for re-election." It was a triumphant day for Biden, though not an unblemished one. As the Senate delivered a great victory for Biden's agenda, the president got upsetting news from elsewhere. In New York, Andrew Cuomo announced he would step down as governor in the face of detailed sexual harassment allegations, marking the abrupt demise of a close Biden ally. More ominously for Democrats, Ron Kind, the centrist Democrat from Wisconsin, who had grown weary of left-wing grandstanding in the House, announced he would retire at the end of his current and 13th term. If Biden hoped policies like the infrastructure bill would help save Democrats from defeat in 2022, Kind's district, a stretch of western Wisconsin where the lawmaker had endured even as rural whites fled to the GOP, would soon put that proposition to a difficult test. Far from unifying Democrats and handing them a powerful message for the midterms, the infrastructure deal helped trigger a standoff between the left and the middle that would come close to tearing the Democratic Party apart. The crunch for Biden's domestic agenda began with a standoff over the rights of tenants and landlords. At the height of the coronavirus pandemic, the federal government issued a series of temporary bans on evictions, citing a severe risk to public health if tens of thousands of people were turned out of their homes. The latest moratorium was set to expire on July 31st, and Biden did not intend to renew it. The Supreme Court had signaled it would look unfavorably on another extension, and White House lawyers did not want to lose in court. The left revolted. Cori Bush, a former Black Lives Matter activist in St. Louis, now serving her first term in the House, held a sit-in on the steps of the Capitol to protest Biden's acquiescence. Equipped with an orange sleeping bag, Bush held a vigil that stretched on for days and drew several colleagues to her side, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. As progressive activists rallied to Bush's banner, the White House scrambled to placate them. Nancy Pelosi wanted to avoid a full-scale panic on the left, and she said so to the White House, urging them to get new legal advice. She suggested reaching out to Lawrence Tribe, the prominent Harvard professor who had his own theory of how to survive the courts. Badgering reluctant White House aides to take action, Pelosi asked them whether they even cared about the impact of evictions on children. Biden relented, and the Centers for Disease Control issued a new moratorium. But the president made his ambivalence plain, noting that the renewed renter protections would certainly face tough legal challenges. His fatalistic tone upset liberals further. Biden's language was not the commentary of someone who is actually trying to help people, said Mondaire Jones, the New York progressive. The episode put the White House in a sour mood. Biden advisers were annoyed with Pelosi, first for pushing them to issue a moratorium they saw as flawed, and then for leaking to the press that she had directed them to Tribe. The White House, after all, was stocked with well-credentialed lawyers, including a chief of staff who had known the Harvard professor for decades. Pelosi's effort to force Biden's hand generated a raw moment of tension between the speaker and the West Wing. Ron Klain, however, was angrier with the left. In private, Klain fumed that the administration had laid out a set of political imperatives for the party and the left was helping nothing by lashing out at the White House. It was not only in the halls of the West Wing where resentment of the left was starting to boil. In the House, lawmakers who had rejoiced at Biden's infrastructure deal were growing exasperated that the bill was stuck in a state of suspended animation while Pelosi awaited a reconciliation deal. A large group of House moderates and members from vulnerable districts wanted Pelosi to skip a drawn-out standoff with the Senate and pass the bipartisan deal immediately. In the reckoning of these Democrats, average voters did not know what reconciliation was or who Joe Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema were. But they did know what roads and bridges were, and they would understand components of the bill like funding for rural broadband and electric buses. It's an easy win, explains Chrissy Houlihan, the Pennsylvania Democrat who nudged White House aides in the spring to turn toward bipartisanship. It's an easy thing to tell people about. These Democrats knew, too, that there was a faction in Biden's White House that agreed with them. Among Biden's aides, there was real disagreement about the next stage of the legislative strategy. Ricchetti, for one, wanted to move the infrastructure bill expeditiously, arguing that it would bolster Biden's popularity and please the centrist Democrats whose support he would need on reconciliation. Klain saw things differently, as did several other key Biden aides. To them, the infrastructure bill was an important piece of a larger agenda that would prove to the country that this was an administration of action. On a practical level, Klain saw no chance of getting robust support from House liberals on infrastructure without simultaneously advancing the rest of Biden's domestic spending plan. If centrists wanted the left to support the infrastructure deal, then the surest way to do that would be for them to support a progressive reconciliation package. These tactical disagreements had a larger ideological component to them. Ricchetti was seen in the White House as an avatar of Biden's centrist core, a pragmatist who shared the preference for consensus-seeking and incrementalism that had defined most of Biden's career. Klain was a more partisan figure, openly skeptical of working with Republicans for its own sake and more invested in Biden's aspiration to record achievements on the scale of the New Deal and the Great Society. Their work histories, at least between government jobs, illustrated their differences. Ricchetti spent years as a high-powered deal-seeking lobbyist, while Klain worked in venture capital and did a stint writing sharp-edged and often thoughtful columns for the Washington Post. What was still unclear to almost everyone in Congress was how Biden himself wanted to proceed. His mixed signals and false starts had created a situation where centrist lawmakers could reasonably claim to be standing up for Biden's agenda by demanding a quick vote on infrastructure, and liberals could just as credibly claim to be championing Biden's cause with their both-or-neither stance on infrastructure and reconciliation. In Congress, Josh Gottheimer was among the lawmakers who had lobbied Pelosi back in July to take quick action on infrastructure. The former Clinton White House aide had helped negotiate the deal from his perch atop the Problem Solvers Caucus, and he was willing to be a thorn in the side of leadership. Pelosi had politely dismissed his initial plea for a vote. "Thank you, dear," she told him. And as August progressed, he marshaled a more combative strategy. A group of 9 moderates came together, a combination of ideological centrists like Kurt Schrader of Oregon and lawmakers in vulnerable districts like Vicente Gonzalez, whose Rio Grande Valley district in Texas nearly turned red in 2020, and Carolyn Bordeaux, a first-term member from the Atlanta suburbs. On August 12th, they issued an ultimatum to Pelosi. "Either hold an immediate vote on the infrastructure bill," they wrote in a letter, "or the group would withhold their support for a budget resolution coming up for a vote at the end of the month." The budget resolution was a kind of placeholder for the multi-trillion-dollar domestic agenda Democrats aimed to pass through reconciliation. Once Congress passed the budget resolution, it would allow negotiators to fill in $3.5 trillion in spending plans, a figure that had been negotiated down from Sanders' original blueprint of $6 trillion. The sooner the House approved the resolution, the sooner Pelosi and the White House could finalize the details and push their social welfare and climate plans into law. The demand from Gottheimer's group of 9 was ostentatiously brash, to the point that even sympathetic lawmakers saw it as obnoxious. It was one thing to press for a speedy vote on infrastructure. It was another matter entirely to threaten to derail the largest remaining piece of Biden's agenda. Pelosi and her leadership team reacted initially with a combination of eye-rolling and disbelief. They did not believe it was a serious threat. In private, Pelosi had a scornful description of the belligerent group. "Amateurs," she called them to her friends. Amateurish or not, the members meant what they said, and they were getting encouragement from outside the chamber. The 2 senators holding up Biden's reconciliation package in the Senate, Manchin and Sinema, had begun to reach into the House in an unusual way, seeking to dislodge the infrastructure bill they had helped negotiate. They urged Gottheimer and his group to hold firm in the demand for a speedy vote. "Stay strong," Manchin told one of them in a phone call on August 12th. The West Virginia senator said he was fed up with the left wing of his party and he wanted the infrastructure vote to happen quickly. "These people are crazy," Manchin said. On August 20th, the House renegades issued a collection of statements reiterating their ultimatum. If Pelosi did not bend, then this group was willing to break the path forward for the reconciliation package. The White House was reaching out to the group of 9 and urging them to back down from their demands, at first gently and then in more menacing language. Ricchetti, normally among the more congenial White House aides, came down hard on them. He still wanted an expedited vote on infrastructure, but the centrists' act of legislative hostage-taking offended him. A handful of House members of any ideology could not be allowed to undermine Biden as the author of his own political destiny. The longtime Washington operator voiced a sense of betrayal with the group of backbenchers that was attempting to strong-arm party leaders. "Anybody opposed to the resolution, it's a deal-breaker with the administration forever," Ricchetti warned one of them. In private, Ricchetti vented anger at one in particular, Jared Golden, the 39-year-old Marine from a pro-Trump district in rural Maine. Golden was one of two Democrats who voted against the American Rescue Plan, and now he was messing with Biden in a more dangerous way. Golden was practically a Republican, Ricchetti told one associate. The Biden advisor floated the idea of recruiting another Democrat to run against Golden in 2022. A week into the standoff, Pelosi was still projecting confidence that the dissenting Democrats would back down. At a weekend retreat for her donors in Napa Valley, the speaker conveyed no sense of fear or anxiety. The party, she told donors, had one strategy for governing and then fighting the midterm campaign in 2022. Stick with Joe Biden. As if to prove her point, Biden phoned Pelosi during a luncheon. The speaker put her iPhone on speaker and held it to a microphone so the president could address her contributors for a moment. Biden tried delivering the same stick-with-me message to one of the troublesome centrists that very weekend. On the evening of Sunday, August 22nd, Biden placed a phone call to Stephanie Murphy. The leader of the moderate Blue Dog Coalition, Murphy had pursued a job in the Biden administration and contemplated a campaign for Senate before opting to stay in the House and serve on the January 6th committee. She also happened to be close personal friends with Kyrsten Sinema. A persuasive overture from Biden might have useful ripple effects. It was not a successful conversation. Biden told Murphy that she and her allies needed to back down. The White House was trying to move the infrastructure and reconciliation bills toward passage side by side, and the Group of Nine was not helping. The 42-year-old Floridian pushed back, telling Biden that she favored changes to the reconciliation bill and objected to progressive stonewalling the infrastructure deal. Still, Murphy told the president she wanted to get both bills done. She wanted to support his agenda. The president bristled. To him, supporting the White House's agenda meant backing his strategy. "Don't kid yourself," Biden told her. "You're the opposition." The call ended on an unpleasant note. But then it had begun that way, too. Biden had opened his chat with Murphy by alluding to another subject entirely, the ongoing American withdrawal from Afghanistan and the messy process of trying to evacuate Afghans who had helped the United States. Then he asked Murphy, who came to the United States as a child refugee from Vietnam, when her family had arrived. Murphy told him they had made it to America in 1979, 4 years after the fall of Saigon. Her parents had worked for the United States and the South Vietnamese government, but they had not been evacuated when American troops left in 1975. Vulnerable to communist reprisals, they had to cut their own desperate path out. It was a story that echoed uncomfortably with the ragged retreat unfolding at that moment in Kabul, events that left scores of Democratic lawmakers as downcast about the Biden administration as they had ever been. John Anzalone's memo on August 20th was clinical in its tone, but the conclusions were grim. The president's pollster diagnosed an abrupt drop in Joe Biden's approval ratings as Americans absorbed the Taliban's rapid conquest of Afghanistan. Voters did not disagree with Biden's decision to end the 20-year war, Anzalone wrote, but they believed the withdrawal was poorly executed and they were blaming Biden. In a document circulated to the White House and a collection of outside allies, Anzalone cautioned that it was too soon to say if the chaotic pullout would take a lasting toll on Biden. His approval numbers had been falling even before the withdrawal, the pollster wrote, in part because of the spread of the Delta variant in the U.S. Biden did not need Anzalone's memo to know that the collapse of Afghanistan was a blow to his administration and to his own stature as a practitioner of global affairs. The president had decided long ago to end the war altogether, overruling some of his senior military commanders who favored keeping a small American force on the ground. In July, he had dismissed the possibility that the Afghan government might crumble, rejecting a reporter's comparison to South Vietnam. The Afghan government and military were far more robust than those of South Vietnam in the 1970s, Biden said. They're not remotely comparable in terms of capability. On August 15th, the Taliban swept into Kabul as the last remnants of Afghanistan's government disintegrated, and the president, Ashraf Ghani, fled the country, just after telling Tony Blinken he would fight on to the end. The Afghan military had surrendered territory to the Taliban across much of the area, while formerly pro-government factions cut deals with the Islamist forces rather than fight and risk a gruesome defeat. In private, Biden expressed feelings of disappointment with his own team. The president felt he had represented the situation in Afghanistan based on the best advice of his intelligence services, military commanders, and hand-picked national security aides. In his view, their guidance had turned out to be wrong. "This is not what you guys have been telling me," he told his advisors as the situation in Afghanistan deteriorated. The outcry on Capitol Hill was ferocious and bipartisan, but muddled on the substance of the withdrawal. Senior Democrats delivered scathing criticism of the pullout, but almost uniformly backed Biden's decision to leave Afghanistan. Hillary Clinton sought to reach Biden because she was concerned about the execution and totality of the pullout. The former Secretary of State believed there should have been some residual American force left in place in the country. Clinton and Biden had not been close for years, and they had nurtured a quiet but intense rivalry ahead of the 2016 campaign when Biden felt that Clinton and his boss, Barack Obama, effectively boxed him out of the race. But Clinton had still been irked not to hear from Biden in the early months of his presidency and told people she believed the president should be consulting with a wider range of voices. Lawmakers in both parties, including a cohort of Democratic military veterans elected in 2018, were working around the clock to help their own Afghan contacts escape the country, and their patience with Biden and his appointees was wearing thin. Republicans were more brutal than Democrats in their criticism of the president and his team, but far more divided on the underlying issue of the Afghan war. While some, like Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham, favored keeping thousands of troops in the country, many Republicans had cheered on President Trump when he called for bringing home the whole American contingent. Kevin McCarthy had been one of those Republicans. In August, the would-be House Speaker sounded incoherent as he blasted Biden for negotiating with the Taliban while defending Trump for doing the same. He chided the administration for pulling troops back from Bagram Air Base while maintaining that he still believed in a full withdrawal from the war. Trump himself jeered at Biden from the sidelines, ridiculing the new president and insisting he would never have allowed such a humiliation to unfold on his watch, a dubious claim given that Trump's demands for a hasty pullout and his administration's talks with the Taliban laid the groundwork for withdrawal in the first place. Yet, in American politics, the sitting president is typically held accountable for overseas chaos and military defeats that happen on his watch, irrespective of whether his opponents are critiquing him in an honest and sophisticated manner. Biden's career was a case in point. He had been elected to the vice presidency in 2008 amid backlash against George W. Bush's war in Iraq, which Biden had supported for years. In his August 20th memo, Anzalone noted that the American people had tangled views on Afghanistan, with 3 in 5 Americans favoring withdrawal on Biden's end of August timetable, and 51% saying it would have been worth it to keep troops there for another year, two positions that were irreconcilable with each other. In any event, he said, the political cost was real. Much like the Delta surge, the events in Afghanistan have drowned out some of the news around the president's Build Back Better agenda, Anzalone wrote, stating the depressingly obvious for the White House. On August 26th, an explosion at Kabul's Hamid Karzai International Airport overwhelmed everything else in the life of the Biden administration. A suicide bomber had targeted the throngs of people massed outside the airport in a desperate quest to leave before the United States abandoned them entirely. Scores of Afghan civilians were killed, along with 13 American service members. The fiasco deepened further after Biden vowed to take retribution. On Sunday, August 29th, the military launched a drone attack in Kabul against a vehicle it said it believed to be carrying an ISIS bomb. Mark Milley, the country's top general, described it as righteous. Within weeks, the New York Times and other news organizations would expose the drone strike as a horrifying atrocity. Its victims had not been terrorists, but an aid worker and his family, with 7 children among them. On the same day as the drone strike, Biden traveled to Dover Air Force Base to receive the remains of the American soldiers slain at the Kabul airport. The somber occasion became yet another illustration of how the country's political divisions were infecting nearly every element of American life. Shayna Chappell, the mother of a slain Marine, berated Biden on the tarmac and accused him of having her son's blood on his hands. Afterward, she went on social media to call Biden a traitor and claimed that he had become president through cheating. Chappell invited Trump to attend her son's funeral. Biden left Dover in a dejected state and returned to Washington. There, he drove to Holy Trinity Catholic Church, the Jesuit parish near Georgetown University that had been a place of worship for the nation's only other Catholic president, John F. Kennedy, 6 decades earlier. Making his way into the pews by himself, Biden eased into a seat 1 row behind a familiar parishioner, Gina Raimondo, the Secretary of Commerce, who was attending Mass with her teenage daughter, Cecilia. Raimondo, noticing the president was alone, invited him to join her and her daughter, and Biden accepted, moving up 1 row to sit beside them. They prayed together quietly, and then at the sign of peace, a moment at Mass when parishioners greet each other, Biden turned to the cabinet secretary who was young enough to be his daughter. "Thanks," he said, "for being a good friend." Gina Raimondo was one of a few prominent figures in Biden's administration who never deviated from selling his domestic agenda. With a wide-ranging economic portfolio and no responsibility for the war in Afghanistan, the former Rhode Island governor spent August and September on a determined campaign of persuasion aimed at an array of congressional moderates in the House and Senate whose support Biden needed for both his infrastructure and social welfare policies. Leveraging her own credentials as a business-friendly centrist, Raimondo was reaching out to a range of vocal lawmakers, including Manchin and Gottheimer. Since she did not have to address them across an ideological divide, Raimondo seemed to feel free to give the lawmakers something of a hard kick. Like the president, she believed Democrats would do better in the 2022 elections if they had a portfolio of compelling achievements to wave around. But Raimondo also made a forthright case to centrists about getting stuff done for its own sake, even if Democrats suffered in the short term. After bonding with Manchin over their shared Italian heritage and background as former governors, Raimondo pointed out that he was famous for complaining about the Senate. Why, then, was Manchin worried about placating his Trump-loving home state? "You don't like this job that much," Raimondo told him. "You liked being governor better. Take the vote, get booted out, wear it as a badge of honor." With Gottheimer, she was even more direct. The two were just 4 years apart in age, and both had endorsed Michael Bloomberg for president out of a determination to beat the hard left in the Democratic primaries. The hard left had been beaten, no thanks to Bloomberg, and now Raimondo was prodding Gottheimer to help the mainstream president pass a daring version of the reconciliation package. "You have a moment right now to do something historic to help America," she told Gottheimer. "If you do the right thing and don't get reelected, so be it." In the last days of August, the Group of Nine cut a deal with Pelosi to let the budget resolution go through in exchange for a crucial promise from the Speaker. Pelosi committed to hold a vote on infrastructure by September 27th. That left just a month for the White House and Democratic congressional leaders to negotiate a deal on the reconciliation package that could clear both chambers. The agreement brought Democrats no closer to real consensus on the strategy or substance of their legislative agenda. It left an almost comically compressed timeline for the various parties to strike a deal on the reconciliation package and then write the actual text of an immense piece of legislation. There was little reason at the end of August to believe Democrats could succeed in doing all of that so quickly. The White House understood that, and so did Democratic leaders in Congress. Negotiations over the reconciliation package had been underway for months already, and no one felt much closer to a breakthrough that would resolve the Democratic Party's serious internal divisions. Manchin and Sinema both wanted to cut the reconciliation price tag from $3.5 trillion to less than half that figure. but they had separate priorities for the remaining spending and had major differences on the subject of fighting climate change. Progressives felt they had already been more than reasonable by lowering the size of Sanders' initial reconciliation draft from $6 trillion to $3.5 trillion. They did not want to scale back their ambitions any further or lose cherished New Deal-style social programs like free community college for all Americans or government-backed dental coverage for the elderly. Embedded in those two negotiating positions were two different views of how to turn the page on the Trump era. To the centrists, Trump represented a decisive turn into politics as a form of warfare, with every issue, every presidential action, and every congressional vote treated as combat. They believed that deal-making and bipartisan cooperation would restore a mood of normalcy and calm in the Capitol and eventually in the nation at large. From the perspective of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, that was a sucker's view. Even if voters told pollsters they cared about bipartisanship, liberals believed Americans cared far more about tangible improvements to their lives. Improvements like the funding for childcare and paid leave programs contained in the reconciliation bill. To the left, purging Trump from the political system meant showing the electorate, including lower-income whites who supported the former president, that government could transform their lives for the better. The left wing believed that Democrats had missed too many chances to do that in the past. As Andy Levin, the House progressive from Michigan, puts it, his wing of the party was now determined to pass an agenda so bold that it would wind up making working-class white people say, "I'd never vote for Donald Trump. I'm voting for the party that puts money in my damn pocket, the Democrats." Most Democrats, including the president, did not want to choose between those two approaches. A large majority of Democrats in the House and Senate wanted to vote for both a robust reconciliation package and the infrastructure deal. The question was whether Biden and his congressional allies could steer those bills around the obstacles thrown up by the feistiest factions of their party, which viewed each other with bitter distrust. On September 10th, Anzalone gave the White House another bracing update on public opinion. Voters still favored Biden's Build Back Better agenda, but the president's job approval rating was underwater and stuck there. Most concerning were Biden's falling numbers on the coronavirus pandemic. A slim plurality of Americans now said that the president had not communicated a clear plan of action. As the Delta variant of the novel coronavirus continues to spread, American confidence in communications from the CDC and President Biden about the public health threat has dropped, Anzalone wrote. The public had good reason to be confused. Despite the government's sustained vaccination campaign, the daily count of coronavirus fatalities and new cases was far higher on Labor Day in 2021 than the previous year. The worst outbreaks were still concentrated in areas where Republican governors had reopened their states rapidly and defied federal public health guidance. But there were also communities of color across the country where vaccination rates were lagging and case counts were comparatively high. It was not only the Biden administration and many other Democrats running out of patience with the unvaccinated, many of whom were marinating in a toxic brew of social media conspiracy theories and anti-vaccine rhetoric on Fox News and other television outlets. On September 8th, Jim Justice, the Republican governor of West Virginia, railed against the crazy ideas of Americans who were ingesting conspiracy theories, such as the idea that vaccines were a way of implanting people with tracking devices. "For God's sakes, a livin'! How difficult is this to understand?" an exasperated justice said during a live-streamed health briefing. On September 9th, one day after Justice's outburst and one day before Anzalone's memo, Biden made his own move. For the first time ever, the president mandated vaccination for all federal employees, and he directed the Occupational Safety and Health Administration to impose vaccine mandates on private businesses with more than 100 employees. Another arm of the government would require vaccination for healthcare workers, while still another would increase fines for airline passengers who flouted masking requirements. Taken together, it was a dramatic use of federal power to force the vaccination campaign forward. Up until this point, Biden had hesitated to employ blunt force tactics with the unvaccinated, leaving it instead to states and municipalities to implement coercive measures and watching from afar as they did so unevenly. But by the fall, the great majority of the country was vaccinated. The Delta variant was still spreading quickly, and Americans were desperate to get out of the pandemic once and for all. Among vaccinated Americans, there was a mounting spirit of resentment toward people who by then had had more than half a year's time to get inoculated and had chosen not to do so. That dynamic burst into view in mid-September with a statewide election in California. Conservatives in the state had engineered a recall campaign targeting Gavin Newsom, the Democratic governor who had implemented strict lockdowns throughout the pandemic and mandated vaccination for state employees earlier in the summer. The leading Republican candidates opposed those measures and caricatured Newsom as a left-wing busybody. Newsom campaigned on his assertive public health strategy, warning in ads that the election was a matter of life and death. National Democrats seemed to agree. Biden broke with his strictly limited travel schedule to campaign for Newsom in the days before the vote, marking his first trip west of the Central Time Zone since taking office. On September 14th, voters rejected the recall effort by 24 percentage points, a decisive outcome even by the standards of solid blue California. In his victory speech, Newsom cast the election as a referendum on public health. "We said yes to vaccines," he declared. "We said yes to ending this pandemic." Newsom had come a long way from his tense conversations with Donald Trump about cruise ships and forest maintenance. The California governor had acted faster than Biden to force compliance from the unvaccinated, and voters had seemed to reward him. White House aides hoped the country would respond the same way to Biden's new mandates. But to run as the party of public health and effective government, Democrats still needed to prove they could get big things done with their power in Washington. As Pelosi's reluctantly imposed September 27th deadline for an infrastructure vote approached, these ambitions were hanging by a narrow thread.